And NPR didn't get a chance to include this very big story that is happening right now. We wanted to tell you about it right away. The U.S. Supreme Court today rejected a last-ditch attempt by former President Trump to shield his financial records. They issued a brief, unsigned order requiring Trump's accountants to turn over his tax and other records to prosecutors in New York. The court's order was a decisive defeat for Mr. Trump, who had gone to extraordinary lengths to keep his tax returns and related documents secret. I was reading that from the New York Times. So big news, Trump's financial records are to be turned over to prosecutors, and NPR will undoubtedly have that story in the next hour. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa, and coming up right now, we're going to hear the Sustainable Living Program.
And baby, I love you. Yes, you're listening to the WMNF 88.5 Sustainable Living Show. We're here in Tampa, and today's topic is all about electric vehicles, their possible promising future, car companies' EV plans, what our government and what clean air advocates are doing. And as always, I'd love to thank our listeners, supporters, our talented staff, and hey, the best bunch of volunteers, including Frank Knox, answering our phones and keeping our space COVID clean, and of course our great news director here, Rob Loride, and he's helping out. Great to see you, Rob.
Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. We were talking a little bit. You lost one of your neighbors down there in South Tampa, and I have some bulls too, and I'm skinny as a rail, but that was a shame. But it's kind of, you know, he's got kind of a colorful past, and what he was doing was kind of objectionable to a lot of us that are involved with the station. But I've had volunteers that have volunteered at the farm, and they came back pretty sad about that. But in a way,
You're talking about Marion Lambert, who raised the Confederate flag in Eastern Hillsborough mm-hmm. County, who passed away suddenly last week. Yeah. But he ran a farm, and he on the trust system sold eggs and honey and all sorts of things from the front of his house.
He was. I guess a good, you know, we're all good and bad. You know, what about all that cold weather, Rob? I mean, in Texas, I mean, that's been in the news every day.
What I keep waiting for is to find out how people that built energy efficiency into their homes and solar into their homes, how did they fare during the blizzard or the snow that affected Texas? So I haven't, Amy Goodman just did a great program about it, but I haven't heard much about how folks who kind of thought ahead, how did they do during the crisis?
Well, you know, what kind of concerns me is the reaction of the rest of the nation. You know, it just seems like we alienate ourselves, like what happens in California. And, you know, I drive to the station and everybody's, you know, pushing that speed limit. They're always 10 miles an hour faster than me, if not more. And, you know, just aerodynamics, you get less gas mileage. And all this is, to me, related to climate disruption. And I think that's been in the news very much, how much this is kind of related to the heating of the North Pole and the jet streams. And it could be, I don't know, we're kind of, it seems like we're waiting for that silver bullet. And we've talked about this on the program before, you know, plan A, plan B, and plan C. And, you know, reading the books and doing interviews over the years on electric vehicles, you know, a lot of the authors, especially the one that wrote the book Plan C, was kind of, yeah, of course, that was, quite a while ago, and things have changed. But, I think we all, there's so many little things that we need to do, and we're not doing them, and I wish people would consider them.
I spent yesterday afternoon outdoors, as I always do during the nice weather days, and was getting back in my car. A woman asked me how I liked my hybrid. And I said, I love it. I love my hybrid. And she said, how many miles do they get to the gallon? And, you know, she's thinking about buying a new one. But I think she was really inspired by seeing my car there in the parking lot.
That's so important. You know, once you do something, just like putting a solar system on your house, you know, and the neighbors kind of look around and they start, you know, talking about the, you know, it's a cash benefit. But, you know, it's just like on the last show we talked about EVs. Solar electric systems. And, you know, everybody's concerned about money, but in reality, you're doing something for society. When you quit using fossil fuel to heat your house, you're doing something for everybody else. You're doing it for your neighbors. You're doing it for yourself. You're doing it for the future. And it's so important. And we don't seem to think about those things, but that's very important.
So you're going to talk about electric vehicles today.
Yeah, we're going to talk about electric vehicles. And I just want to say one more thing, and I'm going to get right to it. You know, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and at the end of the thing, it was about COVID and all that, and the guests... The host always asks one thing that the person felt that we should do that is very important, and that's to love ourselves. And I just kind of wanted to pass that on. Love ourselves, and I don't know. I think that helps to love ourselves, and then we can love others more. First up, the American Lung Association is pushing for the transition to electric vehicles, and joining us is their clean air director. Welcome to WMNF, Will Burlett. You there, Will?
Hey, John. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. And you're joining us from California?
That's right. I live in Sacramento, California, up in the north side.
Well, thanks so much for getting up early in the morning. It's right at 7 o'clock over there, huh?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. Maybe to start, and I'd love to, you know, find out a little bit about the organizations that you know, guests on the program. Could you tell us a little bit about the American Lung Association and its history?
Sure. Well, the American Lung Association is over 115 years old. We're the oldest voluntary health organization in the United States. Our mission is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease, and we accomplish that through research, advocacy, and education.
Uh-huh. And your funding is, do you get any government funding, or how does that funding work?
Well, we get a wide range of grants from foundations, from government grants. We get private donations from listeners like yours and other donors. And basically what we do is we take the resources that we generate, and we put a lot of focus on our air pollution work, our tobacco control work, our lung health work. And this year we actually launched a $25 million COVID-19 initiative to help speed the end of the pandemic and to prevent future pandemics.
Okay, well, thanks so much. And so why is the ALA advocating for EVs?
Well, to put it bluntly, we have a significant air pollution problem in the United States. We have a significant and growing climate change problem in the United States. And the transportation sector is the leading source of some of our harmful air pollutants. And it's the leading source of carbon pollution that drives climate change and threatens public health. So we see this as a key strategy for cleaning up our air and fighting climate change to protect public health.
Cool. So you've kind of gotten together with other organizations, and you're lobbying Congress to do what?
Well, yeah, just last week, we released a letter with over a dozen other health organizations across the country calling on Congress to really prioritize the transition to zero-emission vehicles, zero-emission transportation being, again, a critical solution to our air pollution and climate challenges. And we were joined by, you know, a range of health organizations who see electric vehicles as a key way for Congress to act and to make a priority of cleaning up our air and really building the infrastructure we know we need to spur the development and the deployment of a wide, you know, transition to zero-emission technologies. And, you know, I think it's important to know we had support on that letter from Physicians for Social Responsibility, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Public Health Association, and many more who really see this as an important opportunity for Congress to act now.
Cool. You know, one question that always kind of I have, and I see it over and over again, that with an EV, a lot of people think they're just trading coal power energy, which is a dirtier form of energy, for oil and gas. What would you be your comment?
Well, you know, certainly we know that we need to see the transition to zero-emission vehicles, electric vehicles, happening in parallel with the cleaning up of the power grid. We know that, you know, as we move forward, we're also advocating for more renewables to come online. You all were talking at the outset of the show about getting solar systems up on people's homes, but we also know that industrial scale, we're moving into, you know, more and more renewables coming on the grid, and less fossil fuels. So as that shift happens, we know that today the benefits of zero-emission vehicles are there, but as we move into the future, the benefits are only going to grow the more we have clean, non-combustion, renewable energy like wind and solar powering them.
Well, we're talking with Will Barrett. And Will is with the American Lung Association in California, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So, Will, what are the health effects of the pollution that's coming out right now from cars, trucks, and buses? Do people die from the pollution that's emitted?
Unfortunately, yes. I think it's important to know that the health effects of transportation pollution, air pollution broadly, they can range from asthma attacks to heart attacks, stroke, particle pollution that comes when you think about maybe a diesel truck, diesel particles can cause lung cancer, and unfortunately premature death. We know that also that the effect of poor air quality and local pollution sources, like, you know, if you think about a freeway or a port, for example, there are oftentimes disparities in who is affected by pollution and whose health suffers the most. So we're also very aware of that, and we're very aware of the fact that in the United States, a person of color is 1.5 times more likely to live in a county that receives a failing grade in our annual report because of poor air quality.
If people actually die as a result of this because their asthma gets worse or their lung cancer gets worse, what are the numbers? Are the numbers small? Are we talking about dozens of people who die every year as a result of air pollution-caused disease, or are we talking about a larger number?
Oh, it's certainly a much larger number than that. As far as a national figure, I don't have it off the top of my head. I know that I was just looking at the numbers in California are approximately 7,500 per year premature deaths due to air pollution, about 5,000 due to particle pollution, and about half of that is due to transportation pollution specifically. So, you know, we know that it's a significant problem, and we also know that the cars, trucks, buses on our roads are belching out harmful air pollution, and that's why we're so focused on this transition to zero-emission technology.
If we look at the air pollution that's created by humans, what percent of it comes from cars, trucks, and buses?
Well, it varies by location. In some places, we know it's as high as 80% of the pollution that forms ozone, for example, or smog, can come from the tailpipe. And approximately half of the carbon pollution in some places is due to the transportation sector. And, you know, I'll just point out that last year when the American Lung Association issued our Road to Clean Air report, we looked at this widespread transition and what it could mean for public health. What are the public health benefits of transitioning over the coming decades to 100% of the vehicles sold in the country being zero emission, or heavy-duty trucks, transit buses, school buses. And what we found was we could avoid 6,300 deaths per year, 93,000 asthma attacks per year, over 400,000 lost work days per year avoided because the air would be that much cleaner. And that translates to $72 billion annually in public health benefits. So we're not talking small amounts. We're talking, you know, a big systemic change with big systemic public health benefits.
So, Will, you're out there in California. What is California doing to encourage the transition from traditional gasoline-powered engines to electric vehicles?
Well, last fall, our governor issued an executive order calling for all new cars sold in the state by 2035 to be zero emission. But he also, you know, within that executive order, he put forward a plan for port trucks, so all of the trucks moving goods at our ports, to be completely transitioned to zero emission trucks by 2030. So not even new sales, but like the full transition to port trucks by 2035. And so we're taking a comprehensive view of the transition to electrification. And it's not just California. It's just one example. I just happen to be here, so I'm more familiar. But, you know, we see it across the country where more and more states are adopting plans to get to 100% zero-emission trucks, for example. North Carolina signed on to that last year. And, you know, we see this as a growing momentum. The automakers are moving in the direction of zero-emission. Truck manufacturers are moving forward. Transit bus manufacturers are moving forward in real numbers. And, you know, ultimately we're seeing investment in consumer rebates, investment in infrastructure for charging, and looking at ways that we can really build up the benefits of public, you know, the public health benefits of zero emission transportation in communities that are most impacted by poor air quality. So oftentimes low income communities, communities of color. And there are often, you know, opportunities to do targeted incentive programs or rebate programs for lower income residents, so that if they're looking for a used car, maybe they can make the choice to go from a dirty older car to a used hybrid or used plug-in. And so there are a lot of different ways that this can work and roll out. It's just, again, having to have a comprehensive view and really making it a priority at the policy level.
Okay, and you've been listening to Will Barlett, and he's with the American Lung Association. Will, is there anything else? We're kind of running out of time. I'm sure all this is on your website.
Yes, our website, lung.org/EV for electric vehicle. So lung.org/EV is where you can find a lot of our information about our electric vehicle report, as well as some of our other materials, including a petition to state governors calling for higher priority for transportation electrification. I encourage you to check that out.
Well, thanks so much. Well, really appreciate it. And you're with the American Lung Association's Clean Air. You're their Clean Air Director. Thanks again, Will.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
And next up, we got a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff in the news about EVs recently, new models, technology, new technology regulations, and we have a new U.S. administration. And joining us is the WMNF, joining us on the WMNF Sustainable Living Show is the EV Program Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Welcome back, Dori Larson. You're there, Dori.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you again. Thanks.
Great. Well, first off, maybe just the same, is if you could just tell us a little bit about the Alliance, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
Absolutely. So the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy promotes responsible and equitable energy choices to ensure clean and safe health communities throughout the Southeast. We're a regional organization from Tennessee through the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida. We've got over 30 years of experience being the leading voice for calling out smart energy policies in our region. And my work is under our umbrella called Electrify the South, which is our electric vehicle work. So we leverage research, advocacy, and outreach to promote renewable energy and accelerate equitable electric vehicle adoption throughout the Southeast.
And, you know, Rob asked our last guest what California was doing to kind of promote this clean form of transportation. Can you we kind of focus on Florida now?
Yeah, absolutely. So last year, the House and Senate passed Senate Bill 7018, which is also an infrastructure package that is looking at how we can better build out the infrastructure that we have for electric vehicles across the state. So it calls on different state agencies to take some actions and report back for what kind of policy can be adopted to increase that. So the Public Service Commission held a workshop in October where they were looking at what kind of utility reform might need to happen in order to facilitate EV adoption. And that report we're anticipating coming out any day. The bill also directed the Department of Transportation to create a kind of a master plan for the state And they published an interim report in December with lots of different policy recommendations. And so that Public Service Commission workshop report will be fed into that and gives those kind of utility recommendations, whereas the Department of Transportation is looking at projections, numbers of EVs that we think are going to be on the road and the kind of infrastructure we're going to need to support that. And then also the Energy Office published a EV roadmap where they were looking at the infrastructure itself, where it currently is, what will be needed to support just driving around the state for, you know, that kind of typical high-speed getting around, but also to help support evacuations when we have emergency events. Because, you know, we're a long state and need to have that infrastructure so that somebody who lives in Miami can get out of harm's way in case of a hurricane or something like that.
And what about our car companies? I'm sure you've been following them. It sounds like they got a lot of new, different versions of electric vehicles coming in.
There are tens of models that are coming out within the next few years. And that is really exciting. GM announced that they're going to be spending $28 million to electrify at least 30 vehicles. So there are 30 new models by 2030. Ford then jumped on the bandwagon and said that they were also going to be spending about $25 million to electrify their fleet. They're going to only be offering electric options for the European market by 2030. So there are at least 10 trucks coming to market within the next 2 years. So there's just been flurry of announcements recently.
Cool. And one last question about the Biden administration. What's kind of happening there? What's happening in the White House?
So I don't know if everybody saw that Super Bowl ad with Will Ferrell and Norway, because they've got such high adoption rates. But there's a great piece by The Atlantic, and it's called "The Super Bowl Ad That the Biden Presidency Made Possible." And it's really kind of shines a light on the fact that if the Biden administration hadn't been making these kind of bold steps in terms of executive act orders to electrify the fleet and to create more domestic production of electric vehicles, then probably that ad wouldn't have happened. GM had actually been suing the federal state of California, because they wanted to have stricter regulations than the rest of the country and had a waiver to do that from the EPA for decades now. The Trump administration pulled the waiver and wanted to reset the clean car standards. So when Biden administration, you know, came in, GM within weeks dropped the lawsuit against California and decided that they were actually going to go ahead and be all in. So, you know, elections have consequences, and policy, you know, bold policy statements like that can really help auto manufacturers kind of set the tone of what they're going to do and how they're going to be, you know, producing vehicles.
Dory, that Super Bowl ad, Will Ferrell got mixed up. He went to the wrong country, but he thought he was in Norway, right?
He thought he was in Sweden. Or I said he was in Norway, but he was in Sweden, yeah.
He was in Sweden. So, but in Norway, they have a real move to convert all of their passenger cars, if I'm right, to electric vehicles. Is that right? And how do they do it?
So that is correct. And it did not happen overnight. So for at least 15 years now, they've had a very aggressive education campaign to educate consumers about the benefits of electric vehicles. And that really can't be, I don't think, underscored enough, that it's not just like you flip a switch and people are ready to purchase an electric vehicle. There's certainly a learning curve with understanding how to charge them and all of the things that go along with that. So, but they, you know, along with that, have made commitment to the infrastructure and spending, you know, lots of money on the making sure that there is an infrastructure plan in place that can support that heavy rate of adoption. So right now in Norway, they're actually more electric vehicles are being purchased than gas see if
Do they give incentives to individuals to buy electric cars? Do they say if you'll save money on your taxes if you buy an electric car?
Yeah. So they had tax credits, and they also had perks of driving along the highway system, not having to pay those fees. So yes, there was incentives for consumers.
Oh, so you could avoid tolls by having an electric car. But I'm sure some people would say, well, that's picking winners and losers. And so what you're doing is you're favoring companies like Tesla to sell its cars in Norway. And that's unfair. The government shouldn't do that. What would you say to folks that say that that's unfair?
Well, I mean, we give tons of oil subsidies, millions and millions of dollars in subsidies to oil companies every year. So I don't think that really you're favoring one or the other with that. Like previous guest from the American Lung Association, was pointing out all of the societal benefits to transitioning to electric vehicles. So, really we're all winners when we have cleaner air and, healthier transportation.
There's a bigger picture than just, who wins in the market. The bigger picture is healthier citizens.
Absolutely.
Well, our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And we're talking about electric vehicles, and Dory Larson from the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is here. John Butts is here, and we're going to take some calls from listeners in a few minutes.
Yeah, and Dory, I hate to keep kind of going back to this, but, like here in the Tampa Bay, in TECO, they use a lot of coal to produce our power. And it just seems like I keep hearing that over again, the connection to electric vehicles. What about that?
So I think that that's really an important point to tease out, because people, have that misconception that, well, if you're just going to power your electric cars with coal, then what's the difference? But even with our dirtiest grids across the country, EVs are still 50% cleaner, have 50% fewer emissions than a traditional car. Part of that is because they're just so much more efficient. An electric motor is far more efficient than a combustion engine. And then on the other end of that, as Will mentioned, we're cleaning our grid, and that's part of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's mission as well, is to, ensure that we are taking that utility reform piece and pushing for more and more renewable energy on the grid, so that, electric vehicles every year are getting cleaner because the grid itself is getting cleaner.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's always that question about the batteries and, where that stuff is extracted and the conditions for the workers there, and then recycling these products.
Right. So, obviously, we want to make sure that we're not robbing Peter to pay Paul with environmental practices, and mining for the battery components is certainly important in terms of, the environmental impact and also the human impact. A lot of research is going into looking at battery composition and trying to improve that composition so that you're not needing as much of the lithium. There's a plan to phase out cobalt for most of the batteries going forward. And, there in the future could be other, a lot more readily accessible elements going into the battery composition. And that's part of, making a better product as we go forward with this.
Uh-huh.
And then in terms of the recycling, there are federal government resell is with the energy office looking at how to build up those recycling efforts, because it is a lot cheaper to recycle the lithium and the other minerals that go into the batteries than it is to mine for them. And manufacturers are well aware of that. So I think that you'll see a lot more of that in the future.
And just one real short question, and I just read this recently, and I don't believe it, but anyhow, they were saying that it costs more to make an electric motor for an EV than an internal combustion engine. What do you think about that statement?
So the most expensive component of making an electric vehicle is the battery.
Okay.
And the cost of the battery packs has come down about 90% in 10 years. And most market projections show that by mid-century or mid-decade, so mid-20s, the battery cost will be at parity of a traditional vehicle. So you'll be able to pull off the lot the same price point. And then obviously you're saving over $10,000 over the cost over the course of the lifetime of the vehicle in lower maintenance and lower fuel costs. So even if you buy a car today, it's cheaper to drive an electric vehicle in a lot of cases, even with that higher premium. But once that cost parity happens, you know, 2024, 2025, it will make that financial argument right as you pull off the lot.
Yeah, gas engines are so much more complex because you've got a radiator, you've got gears and transmissions, and you don't have any of that stuff. You don't have oil changes for an electric vehicle. So you, as you just pointed out, you save a lot of money in maintenance. But how fast are electric cars?
They're super quick. They've got instant torque, so they have that single-speed transmission, so you can go 0 to 60. The fastest production car in the world is the Tesla S in ludicrous mode, the performance model, 0 to 60 in 2.27 seconds. So you're really not trading out function or performance with an electric vehicle. They're much better, actually, than a traditional car.
Now, John doesn't like to be passed by fast drivers, so I shouldn't have brought that up, John. I'm sorry.
Tesla can pass me anytime.
Okay, so let's take some calls from listeners. We're talking about electric vehicles here on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And let's go to Pat in Seminole. Pat, you're on. What's your question?
Hey, I just was glad to hear some real-life or real-world examples. I've got a 14-year-old Honda gas engine, obviously, and the repairs on the thing are going to cost more than the car is worth. So I'm in the dealership, and they're saying, buy the Honda Fit, couple years old, completely gas, you know, $15,000 or less it's going to cost me. So how much are the electric vehicles? And, I mean, honestly, I would prefer a hybrid, but if it's a matter of having this dinosaur car that I'm buying, like a 2018 or 20 or something like that, how do you make the argument to say don't buy the gas car compared to getting a hybrid at $15,000 or less? Real world example. Anyways.
So I think a lot of people, and that's a great question, a lot of people think that an electric vehicle is a lot more expensive. If you look at like a brand new car, Kelley Blue Book average is about $39,250 for a traditional car. An electric vehicle is about $43,000 for a new EV. So they're only about $4,000 different right off the bat. So I just wanted to kind of dispel that notion that they're far more expensive. I think a great option in my personal story is I bought a used Nissan Leaf. I bought it in 2017. I paid $8,400 for it and do not have any, you know, like Rob mentioned, no oil changes, really no maintenance other than like windshield wiper and rotating the tires. So a used EV is actually a great choice.
I see. Yeah, because I wouldn't be starting at a $40,000 car. I mean, the Honda Fits are like $18,000 for a brand new 2020, and I'm wondering if anybody buying a gas-powered car today is going to have a useless dinosaur, or if they're going to have something that people are going to go, oh, remember when there were gas vehicles? Look, that's a pretty nice Honda. Anyways, never mind. Thank you for the information. I have to weigh and measure and make a financial decision, I guess, before an environmental decision at this point. That's the deal for me, right?
Yeah. Probably, you know, and I just wanted to chime in. You know, on past EV shows and hybrid shows, we've had on used car dealers that specialize in EVs, and they completely always talk about how reliable they are, and even a hybrid, they don't use up their brakes because they have regenerative braking. You know, they talk about, you know, I'm not trying to sell Toyotas, but how, you know, bulletproof the Toyota Prius is, and all these these cars. And I always, you know, you lose a lot of money when you drive off of that car room floor. And I always, you know, if you can find, you know, somebody pretty reliable and get the service records on that car, that, you know, I would consider definitely, even for a woman that doesn't know, you know, I'm not saying that women don't know a lot about cars, but the people that don't know a lot about cars, that, you know, it's a good choice to even, you know, what the heck, to buy a used car as long as you kind of know the history of it.
Yeah, and that's it exactly. I'd be looking at maybe a 2018, but gas-powered, and I hate that because I want to do something for the environment. But you hear about the batteries, that it costs as much as the car to replace the battery, and I'll go offline because maybe you answered those questions previously and I just got in on the phone line now. So I don't want it to cost me more in the long term for buying a hybrid, an older hybrid that I can afford, than something that's, you know, $15,000 and 2 years old, that's a Honda Fit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know,
understand.
I'll just tell you a quick story. I bought a hybrid about a year ago, and the battery pack is guaranteed for 10 years. And I used to spend on my old-fashioned car about $2,000 a year on gas. Now I spend about $600 a year on gas. So I figure, you know, there's a long way off before I'll have to replace the battery pack. The battery pack is guaranteed by the company for 10 years. So I'm pretty happy, and I'm saving a lot of money.
And a lot, most car manufacturers transfer that. When you sell a car, you still get the warranty on the battery pack. Makes sense.
Right. And I think that, like, the point that you're really making here is, if you look at the total cost to own and you actually factor in not just the purchase price, but the, you know, the cost of the repairs and the cost of the maintenance and the cost of the fuel, it is frequently cheaper to own an electric vehicle or a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, than it is. MIT has got this great tool that you can use, and also I'll share with the folks, they maybe can put it up on the website to share with the guests, that there's also tools from the EPA that allow you to compare cars side by side. So you can see, like, the total cost to own, and frequently it works out for electric vehicles and hybrids, and especially if you're considering use, because of those federal tax credits. On a lot of the vehicles, when you go to purchase them used, they factor that into the cost, and you can, you know, find lots of used electric vehicles under $15,000.
All right, Pat, thanks a lot. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for the information. Bye.
Thank you. And Dory, do people still get a tax break if they buy an electric vehicle in the U.S.? Do they get a federal income tax break?
Yeah, there is a federal tax credit. It's by the manufacturer. So if the manufacturer has sold more than 200,000 units, then it starts to sunset. So Tesla and GM do not any longer qualify for federal tax credits, but all of the other manufacturers do. And then at the federal level, they're looking at extending that right now. So the idea isn't to keep those, you know, like you mentioned, you know, playing favorites. The idea isn't to keep those in place forever, but just to help the, you know, the developing technology catch on and then phase those out, so that, you know, by the time, you know, in maybe 5 years' time, when they're at cost parity, you wouldn't need those to help support the market anyway.
Let's go to another call. Let's go to Pat in Plant City, who has a question. Pat, thanks for calling. What's your question?
I was just wondering what she thought about the Volkswagen ID.4. If that's going to be a good deal or not? Because I ordered one, but I'm kind of hesitating versus the Tesla. The Tesla's such a success story. I feel like I'm going out on a limb with that new VW, but it appears to be a good investment because of the tax credit. And so what are your thoughts about that choice?
I think that there are lots of good choices, and Current Driver just looked at reliability for electric vehicles, and the Bolt and the Nissan Leaf and the Model 3 were all ranked very high for that. I think that, you know, I personally own a used Leaf, like I mentioned. My husband leases a Bolt, a Chevy Bolt, all electric. So we have other models besides Tesla. And then I also have, our organization has a Tesla Model 3, so I drive all three on a regular basis. The Tesla, I will say, has their infrastructure built out so that it is just very easy to take a trip to California if you want to. Whereas the other manufacturers have not invested in the infrastructure themselves. They're relying on the utilities to do that and other, you know, third-party makers of the charging units. So that's something to consider. I think if you take frequent long trips, it might be, you know, worth looking at Tesla. But
And Dora, do you know anything about the VW, the new electric VW?
They have got a, they're going to use, similar to other manufacturers, one kind of skateboard platform where they can build out the batteries, and some of them will be manufactured in the U.S., which is great. I think the ID.4 is slated to be built here in a couple of years. And so, like, they have that system where they can just build the platform and then pop the different tops on top, almost like Legos, to build it out. And I will say, because of the Dieselgate, you know, scandal with the violating the Clean Air Act, Electrify America was built out as part of Volkswagen, a part of the settlement. So they are, you know, installing infrastructure in quite a few large municipalities across the country as well. So that infrastructure system is being built out as well.
All right, Pat in Plant City, does that do it for you, or do you have another question?
No, I wanted to offer some advice for the earlier Pat. There's a real good car dealer in, I think it's Lutz. Isn't it Tampa Bay Hybrids? The guy's name is Todd. He's real honest. He's got all kind of hybrid choices and stuff, and he's just a great local asset. He's honest. He's straightforward, and, you know, I don't want to talk bad about car dealers, but in my experience, he's really a great guy, and he'll be honest with her and help her with her decision. But I would encourage her to at least buy a hybrid, just kind of in my experience. I had a Nissan Leaf. I loved it. It was like a third car. I ran all around town in it. But when I would go from Plant City to St. Pete, it just wasn't convenient. And so then I have a Honda Clarity plug-in hybrid, which is great. But I'm an extreme environmentalist, and I don't want to burn any fossil fuel. I'm trying to do as much damage to that industry as possible. So that's why I'm leaning towards electric more than anything. But I'm kind of weird that way.
Right.
Pat, thanks a lot, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, we're talking about electric vehicles today on WMNF on the Sustainable Living Program, and our guest is Dory Larson from the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Dory, this is a little bit off topic, but you're part of a group that advocates for solar. Jim writes, I'm in St. Pete, and I watched a house near me get an entire roof made up of Tesla solar shingles. It looks really good. Do you all have any information on how well these new solar shingles work, writes Jim.
I do not have direct experience with the Tesla shingles, but I will just, as a side note, say that it's very easy when you're installing solar to install a charging station in your garage. That's what we did, and absolutely love it.
Clark in Ybor City writes, what do your guests recommend about the tax revenue for roads that's currently derived from gasoline? When we switch to electric, we'll have less gas tax and less money for road repair, writes Clark.
I think that Clark is spot on in that we are going to have less money. We've been having less money for the past 30 years, and cars have become more energy efficient, fuel efficient, and we really have not adjusted the federal level for inflation. But I think tying the way that we pay for our road infrastructure to a fossil fuel is kind of an albatross around our neck. I think at the federal level, we need to very heavily be considering, you know, coupling how we pay for roads with fossil fuels if we're trying to get ourselves off of fossil fuels. I think we're going to have to be looking at alternative ways to do that. Right now, Senator Brandis has a bill that would create a fee for EV drivers. And, you know, the Southern Alliance does feel that electric vehicle drivers, like all drivers, should be paying fair share of, you know, maintenance for the roads. But just making sure that the fees are not almost predatory, like in some states where they've been slapping on $200 and $300 fees that, you know, really diminish the cost savings in driving electric and are really kind of punitive. But what Senator Brandis's bill proposes is actually using part of the fee to pay for more infrastructure, for charging infrastructure, and then that will sunset out and be phased into paying for the general road fund.
Mm-hmm. Suzanne writes, do EVs come in SUVs? I transport animals and I need extra room, writes Suzanne.
Yes. So there's a great website called Plugstar. It's run by Plug in America. You can type in your zip code and it will show you all of the models that are available. And so Audi has an SUV. Chrysler Pacifica is a minivan that's a plug-in hybrid electric SUV. There is, BMW has an SUV. Jaguar has an SUV. The Model Y Tesla is an SUV. And more manufacturers, they understand that that's kind of what Americans are used to driving at this point and are coming out with newer models. So like Nissan Ariya should be out later this year or next, and it is a compact SUV. There's lots of crossover types that have lots of room in the back as well.
John, we've got a call from Karen in Plant City, so let's go to Karen. Karen, hi, you're on the air. What's your question?
Well, good morning. Not really a question. I was just wanted to support your one lady caller that was hesitant about making the purchase of an electric car, and I just wanted to give a little testimonial. I've been driving my Nissan Leaf for 4 years all over the place. So with no trouble, nothing. I don't go for tune-ups or oil changes, and it's a great urban car. I plug it in at my house every night, and I can zip around. I have a 100-mile range, and I think one of the things that you have to consider is what your driving habits are currently. And there are more and more charging stations becoming available. So that was just a little support for making that transition and without fear.
And Karen, maybe tell them how you actually leased this and then you bought it, right?
Yes, I did a lease, and then I did a lease buyback. The cost of this vehicle new made me reconsider getting a brand new one, just for the same reasons the lady caller had, was the cost of some of the new ones. So looking at a used one is a really good idea. This car is, like I said, I've had it for 4 years. It's actually 5 years old. It's sat on the lot for a year before they sold it to me new. So it's just trouble-free.
All right, good.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you for the testimonial. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So, Dory, it's often said that China is doing nothing to curtail its emissions and it's going full speed ahead. The critics say, with coal and oil, is that true, or is China taking a lead on trying to reduce emissions?
Well, in terms of electric vehicles, they really have been taking quite a bit of a lead. They've transitioned quite a large percentage of their electric transit buses and have been really ramping up manufacturing of electric vehicles. They have, more manufacturers that are all electric than we do currently. So that's, another exciting, aspect of the Biden administration making that announcement that he wants to increase production in America, because it's not just the vehicles themselves, but it also is, the battery manufacturing and making sure that we're not feeding that leadership role to China, which, at this point kind of has, they've been working at it longer than we have and really prioritizing electric transportation. So,
I was reading over the weekend, I think it was in the New York Times, it said that in a few years, China will have 125 battery plants around its country. Europe will have 17 and we'll only have 10.
Exactly. And so making sure that those supply lines, that we have them intact and domestic is really important.
Yeah, we're way behind when it comes to battery technology. China's jumping out ahead. Jared writes this, we had a battery go bad on our Prius, and it was $900 for a refurbished battery. It had a one-year warranty, and it cost $1,500 for a five-year warranty. They installed the refurbished battery in our Prius in 45 minutes in my driveway, and 3 years out, I've got no problems.
Good news.
That is great news, but I just wanted, there's a definite distinction between the battery in a hybrid that is gas only and the batteries that are in plug-in hybrids and all electric. It's a very different battery composition, but they are, like you mentioned before, warrantied for 8 years or 100,000 miles. So, you know, with a traditional car, once it gets past 8 years, 100,000 miles, you're looking at significant replacement costs of transmissions and things like that. So,
yeah, sometimes a new engine on a gasoline-powered car.
Yeah.
Mike and Brandon writes, what's the downside of EVs? Are the batteries going to cause any damage to the environment once the batteries are out of service?
So that's, you know, a great question. Again, to the batteries, and making sure that we are repurposing them after their usefulness in a car does not mean that they aren't useful for other things. So typically, if a battery gets to about 60% of its full capacity, that's when they need to swap it out of the car. And then it can still be used for example, in Japan, Nissan is pairing them with solar panels and using them to as energy backup for streetlights. So you can, you know, recycle and reuse the batteries for other purposes, but then also recycle the actual components and reuse the lithium, and all of those metals can be reused.
And Charlie from Lutz writes, what's the average recharge time for the average electric vehicle?
So there's three different ways to charge. There's level one charging, which is a standard outlet, like a regular wall outlet. That's a 110 volt, and that is typically adds about 5 miles per hour. So if you have a 40-mile commute and you plug in for 8 hours at night, then you would replenish that. And that's what I did for the first 2 years that I owned my electric vehicle. There's also level two charging. So level two charging is a 240 volt outlet, so similar to what you would use for a stove or for a clothes dryer. And you can have that. I had one installed in my garage and then plugged in the charging unit. And that adds about, it depends on the amp, but between 20 and 30 miles per hour. So it's a much faster charge. And then there's DC fast charging. DC fast charging on the Tesla can recharge the battery to about 80% capacity in about 30 minutes. Wow. So it's just a much faster direct current charge to the battery.
Okay, Dory, thank you very much. We're getting kind of towards the end of the show. Maybe tell us your website there.
Yeah, so it's electrifythesouth.org. Got information about different types of models, and we also have a policy toolkit. So a lot of the work that I do is advocating for local governments to adopt policies that will help increased infrastructure, and also looking at fleet conversions for local governments. So electrifythesouth.org.
Cool. And, you know, the last guest, Will, he was talking about a letter to the governors. Do you know anything about that? I was going to ask him again where we could kind of participate. That was to another guest, but, you know.
Right. It was the American Lung Association's website. They have, he said that the link was there to their to that petition.
Okay, Bob. Well,
all right. Well, Dory Larson from the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, thanks for coming on WMNF.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And John, thanks a lot. Thanks
Thank
for
you, Rob.
Great show.
We'll see you whenever.
Okay, you'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Well, I'm assuming that Tanya or Grace are going to do the next couple of shows. They're going to put me back out to pasture.
Okay. All right. Well, John, thanks a lot. Great to see you. And you've been listening to the Sustainable Living Program here on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. In just a moment, we're going to get the latest news and find out about the Supreme Court decision on Donald Trump's tax returns. That's coming up in just a second.